Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil, like a lot of it. Yep, that's good. Then I stare at a red light. It's the kind that helps your cells positively glow. Oh, wow, really bright. Okay. Next, I take an ice bath. That's how you melt your fat and fix your, I don't know, other stuff. Ooh, yep, feeling super healthy. Can't feel my toes. Breakfast is raw liver. Okay, here we go. Oh, real good.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at cygnos.com. That's cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls. You don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. I want to thank you all so much for listening and supporting the show. You are the absolute greatest, and I love connecting with you on Instagram and via email. Just thank you. So hopefully you have recovered from the crazy train that is Jane Whaley. Hopefully enough to enter the dark mind of today's monster hiding behind the cloth. A man so evil and sick that he himself openly admitted to the police that he really is a monster. This whole episode needs an intense trigger warning, so please take care while listening. Gluttony. Gluttony is the overindulgence and overconsumption of anything to the point of waste. A glutton is not interested in quality, but quantity. They have an insatiable thirst for whatever they desire. They gulp and gorge these cravings. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with food, though it can. You can be a glutton for drugs or alcohol, glutton for sex, a glutton for control. And in our case, John D. White was a glutton for devious sex, for dominance, and for blood. John D. White escalated his actions with every twisted neuron firing in his brain. He sought to douse the flames of his obsessive thoughts with an avaricious intensity, yet he still couldn't get enough. White had no off switch. If he desired it, he took it no matter how much it destroyed people's lives, and he would disguise his devils with the mask of a reformed and remorseful man while he committed his most vile act right under his congregants' and his fiancée's noses. So who is John Douglas White? Was he once a young boy destined to preach in front of a pulpit? Did he dream of a saintly life? Was he called to be one of God's chosen? Hell no. John D. White traversed America through his bouts in the Navy and behind the wheel of a big rig, long-haul trucking his terror across the Great Plains and beyond. White abused a multitude of drugs, only adding to his absolute lack of self-control. It is said that the sin of gluttony comes from being weaned improperly as an infant, as there is not much reported on John's childhood, besides that he was born on May 20th, 1957. We can only speculate that that is why, or maybe because of an undiagnosed mental illness that plagued him most of his life. Or he really could be exactly what he says that he is, a monster.
Yeah, I am definitely a monster. I am a terrible monster.
White's first known attack came after returning from serving in the Navy. He was 22 years old, married, living in Battle Creek, Michigan, with his wife when he attempted his first unspeakable crime, the attempted murder of a 17-year-old girl. One day in 1980, White's neighbor Teresa knocked on his front door. A tragic mistake for the poor teenager, as Teresa went to his door by mistake. She was looking for a friend of hers and got the wrong door. Well, she didn't get the answer she wanted, and certainly not the person she was looking for. White wasn't done with her. He lured her down to his basement with the promise of seeing the racetrack he had built. Alone with White in that dark basement, chills went up Teresa's spine as White loomed behind her as she admired the racetrack, a sinking sense coming over her that she was now stuck alone in this small space with no one to help her. She knew she needed to get out of there, and fast. Here is Teresa recounting her harrowing story on the show, Sinister Ministers.
And I got a really cold feeling. I just heard in my head, "You need to go." He ran up behind me before I could get to the stairs. He had stabbed me under my right shoulder blade. I kept trying to push him. I scratched, I bit, I yelled, I pleaded. He would just tell me to lay there. I was so scared. And all I kept saying was, "Please, please." He brought the knife up. And I remember saying this in my head, "He's gonna cut my throat." So all I did, I put my head down and I said, "I'm just gonna pray that it's quick." And he cut my chin. I was stabbed 15 times, full through, 6.5 inches each time. I remember each and every one of them, because, you know, it's like it's in slow motion. It's like, really? That's what that feels like? Oh my God.
Can you imagine that? Feeling multiple stab wounds, feeling so alone. When White left her for dead, she was lucky though. A neighbor heard her screams and had already called 911. White was taken into custody and went on trial. A jury convicted White of attempted murder. In a bid to avoid prison time, White apologized and asked for help instead of prison, manipulating people into thinking that he was ready to work on himself. White told the judge, quote, "I wouldn't listen to people that tried to tell me that I did have a problem, and I realize that now." But that wouldn't be the last time White would attack, and his crimes only got worse. He spent time in prison and indulged in more fantasies, even confessing to a prison psychologist that he had begun fantasizing about having sex with the dead. Listen, I'm all for getting psychological treatment in prison and otherwise. Hell, I think it has helped many people. But I honestly think that John D. White got his gluttonous rocks off even more when confessing his depraved thoughts to the psychologist, even threatening to make the prosecutor and his defense attorney his victims. Sources told Target 8 News that White told a prison psychologist about his fantasies to kill the prosecutor and his defense attorney and have sex with their bodies. He was truly ramping up his depravity. Meanwhile, thank God, Teresa survived. The 17-year-old was alive but terrified. However, she felt some relief in the fact that the justice system had promised to protect her. She said, quote, "They sent him away and they left me alone. Quote, they promised me he wasn't going to ever hurt anyone again." Little did Teresa know that the judge had only sentenced White to 5 to 10 years in prison, a sentence John D. White was set to appeal, and this bastard won. He won on the grounds that his attorney didn't raise an insanity plea. So John D., D for disgusting, White was released after only 2 years in prison and was given the luxury of only another 2 years of probation and mandatory mental health treatment. To Teresa's horror, she would soon discover in the most vulnerable of circumstances that she was no longer protected by the law. Did the police, the justice system, the courts call to warn her of White's release? Nope. This is how Teresa found out. A few years after his release, Teresa was standing in line when she recognized a voice behind her. She turned around, and with a sinister smile on his face, John D. White was staring right at her. White was free. Teresa would years later retell her survival story on various news outlets and specials on White. She appears to be doing well despite her horrific near brush with death at the hands of John D. White, a man who was now free to roam and act out his disgusting fantasies. And he would find that with a little charm and manipulation, he gets people on his side. He left prison and settled in Kalamazoo, Michigan, stayed married, and made some new friends. Frederick Nichol was not the first and not the last person to give John D. White the benefit of the doubt. Frederick described him as a fun guy with a great sense of humor. He knew when he became friendly with White about his 1981 assault conviction in the attempted stabbing murder of a 17-year-old girl. But White convinced him that he was a changed man. Frederick met White while they were both long-haul truckers together in the late 80s and early 90s, and even spent hours upon hours riding with him on the lonely stretches of highway in White's cab, talking, shooting the shit, feeling somewhat comfortable in White's presence. Frederick even said that in all the hours he spent with White, his friend only showed a violent side once. At a way station in Ohio, he said, White hurled slurs at a female Department of Transportation worker who was making him change a flat tire. Frederick said he clearly remembers that exchange surprised him. Quote, mostly he was a real gregarious guy, real easygoing. Quote, I never saw any behavior that would lead me to believe that he had done any of these things, except for that one incident. Frederick did, however, reveal that White was somewhat of a connoisseur of the seedy stops along the highway, saying, quote, he was kind of a perv, Frederick said. He knew how to talk to all the prostitutes on the radio. He knew where all the seedy semi-truck stops were. All of his stories from the Navy had to do with ports of call and ladies of the night. But despite these two scenarios, Frederick continued to just see White as a pervy dude who had largely changed his violent ways. But that all changed when Frederick suspected White of his second known slaying and eventually broke all ties with him when his former friend's evil was officially exposed. Frederick likely knew of White's affair with Vicky Sue Wall, a woman White met previously while working a maintenance job at a textile company where Wall also worked. White was still married with two kids and one on the way. But despite that, White and Vicky began an affair that lasted a number of years. White introduced Vicky to Frederick as a friend, but Frederick knew better. So when Vicky Sue Wall went missing in the early hours of July 1994, Frederick suspected something wasn't right. Frederick's suspicions were only exacerbated when White began talking about suicide around the time of Wall's disappearance, saying that he wanted to spare his wife and children from enduring another trial. What trial could he be talking about, you ask? Well, Frederick had a clear gut feeling he knew. White even said to his friend, quote, It would be maybe a week or so, then his wife would have suicide letters she would hand out that would explain everything. This man is a coward in every sense of the word, and his cowardly behavior will only continue to sicken you more as the story goes on. The night after White's suicide plan was exposed to Frederick, he spotted White riding his bike down the side of the road. He pulled over and White said he was on his way to kill himself. Frederick went to go check on his wife and kids at home, and when he arrived, White's wife asked if her husband was already dead, and she said she suspected he had killed someone. This is so devastating on so many levels, and maybe mostly because White would live to see another day, in fact, another few decades, where he would get out of prison and continue his destruction of people's lives. So how did John D. White know the cops were onto him? Well, the last time Vicky Sue Wall was seen was in a surveillance video from a grocery store parking lot, which showed her getting into a black pickup truck with a bearded man at 3 a.m. It was the last time anyone ever saw her alive. That's because when she got into White's car that night in the Meyer parking lot, White immediately punched her in the stomach and then put a zip tie around her neck and strangled her. I just have to say there's another major trigger warning here, and maybe I should have said it right before that last paragraph, but after strangling her, White then drove out to the woods, had sex with her corpse, and disposed of her body. John D. White was now a full-blown necrophile. I wanted to do my best to understand and learn the psychology behind necrophilia, so I purchased a research paper written by Michelle L. Stein and other psychologists. Here is what I discovered in my research regarding the pathology of a necrophile. In Michelle L. Stein's paper, Necrophilia and Sexual Homicide, she writes, "Necrophilia literally means love of the dead and is generally defined as sexual relations with corpses. The disorder has been recognized since ancient times and has become part of popular or not-so-popular culture in some songs by metal bands. Currently, necrophilia is classified by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as an unspecified paraphilia with no generally agreed-upon specific diagnostic criteria except for post-mortem sexual activity with a body. The disorder is considered relatively rare. However, its true prevalence is unknown and is perhaps unknowable, as most necrophiles will avoid being fully truthful about their acts. Two other researchers studied 122 cases of necrophilia and found 14 subjects, so 12% of their sample, who committed homicide to obtain a corpse for sexual purposes. Although the literature on necrophilia is sparse, the association of necrophilia with sexual homicide has been consistently recognized. In these instances, the primary motivation for the murder was sexual gratification, or the homicide was triggered by an eruption of sexual conflicts, followed by an impulsive engagement in necrophilic acts. Such offenders seek pleasure not only in bringing about the deaths of the victims, but also in finding an indescribable gratification and satisfaction of their passion in post-mortem mating with the victim they had tortured to death. In my opinion, one could conclude that there's so much shame involved that that's why they downplay it. Similar to John D. White, who later would claim that he touched his victim but doesn't remember if he had sex with her or not. He also blames alcohol and blackouts for him possibly engaging in necrophilia. Okay, back to their research on what motivates a necrophile. A conclusive explanation of the motivational dynamics of these subjects is not possible, but statements by offenders and opinions of investigators provide some understanding of this rare post-homicidal conduct. For instance, all of the offenders denied committing the homicide specifically to obtain a corpse, and none would explain their motivation for having sexual involvement with the corpse. Two of the offenders rationalized the homicide and necrophilia as a consequence of being in an intoxicated state, similar to White. Those involved in the investigations concluded that the offender's primary intention in all these cases was homicide. They viewed the necrophilia as possibly engaged in because the murder itself was not sufficiently satisfying to the offender. So it is not necessarily to obtain a willing partner, which many people think. The most common explanation for necrophilia is that offenders need to have an unresisting and unrejecting partner. But the lifeless condition itself, a human form absolutely without will, is seen to be capable of absolute subjugation without the possibility of resistance. However, since six of the subjects studied were involved in marital or marital-like relationships, like John D. White, and almost half the victims we studied were raped prior to death as well as after, it would seem that these offenders did not need an unresisting partner in order to perform sexually. Several authors have put forth other views of the motivational dynamics of necrophilia, specifically when it occurs in association with sexual murder. For example, one of them believes that these offenders have a desire to further destroy and degrade their already lifeless victims. The necrophilic acts associated with sexual murder are, quote, an extension of the offender's violation of the victim. More recently, two other researchers have offered a much different theory of the connection between necrophilia and sexual murder. They conclude that in these cases, offenders seek to outrage society and call attention to their total disdain for societal acceptance. And more importantly, psychosis is not always at play. Many experienced clinicians often incorrectly, quote, find themselves tempted to ascribe psychosis to those individuals who engage in extraordinarily cruel acts, despite the absence of delusions, hallucinations, or markedly illogical thinking. In fact, most sexual murderers are not psychotic. And there was no adequate information or documentation that any of the sexual murderers in our study who engage in necrophilic acts displayed any indications of a psychotic process. Remember, White doesn't say he is mentally ill. He simply calls himself a monster. Listen again.
Yeah, I am definitely a monster. I really am. I am a terrible monster.
Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
Sinners. White likely knew this day would come, hence why he began to threaten suicide. So when White was picked up for police questioning, no one was surprised. White admitted the affair with Wall to police, but claimed he dropped her off safely later on. Police didn't believe his claims, but there was no body and no real evidence to charge him. They did find traces of blood in his truck, but DNA testing was still in its early stages, so there wasn't much they could do with that. Detectives then spoke to his wife, who confessed to them that White had multiple personalities, and White himself claimed that he suffered from blackouts. But he was still a free man. Until 6 weeks later, Wall's body was found dumped in a rural area 2 miles from the grocery store where the two were captured on video. This gruesome discovery by a local hunter of Vicky Sue Wall went like this.
I noticed two drag marks. And as I got further, I seen a white tennis shoe. Right then when the odor hit me and I noticed the skull was showing, that's when I turned around and hightailed it out of here.
Vicky's body was naked, except for a shirt and bra around her neck. But poor Vicky Sue Wall's body was so badly decomposed that police could not determine exactly how she was killed. But it was determined that it had to have been a homicide. White refused to talk with police or take a lie detector test, but a luminol test of White's pickup truck showed evidence of blood in several areas. But the evidence was again severely limited. Due to this lack of real evidence, White agreed to plead no contest to involuntary manslaughter and received an 8 to 15 year sentence in prison. At his sentencing in May 1995, White called Wall's death a tragic accident, literally taking no accountability or blame for what he did, then said, quote, "I love Vicky." Gross, gross, gross. John D. White, you love no one but yourself. And your victims don't just extend to the women you've attacked and killed. It extends to your wife and children as well. In prison, White would write more pathetic letters to his wife, one saying, quote, "I am just feeling some relief now that things are starting up," adding that he was coming to grips on the possibility that I may go to prison for the rest of my life, and I can't help but think it might be better for you and for the kids. Oh, that's so big of you, John. But in prison, White's confessions and letters wouldn't be all self-loathing and roses, because he would continue to confess to psychologists of his obsession with having sex with corpses. They all agreed he was a very disturbed man who shouldn't be set free, but they could only hold him as long as his sentence dictated. So, shockingly, in 2007, after serving nearly 13 years for Vicky Sue Wall's death, White was a free man. Prison officials say he went through group therapy sessions as well as violent offender treatment, and they did the best they could. His old friend Frederick was shocked by his release. Frederick even ran into White once after his release from prison, where White told him he was now an ordained minister and had been forgiven for his sins. Quote, "As far as I was concerned, he didn't do the right time because he didn't get charged with the right crime," Frederick said. So, what was John D. White to do now? Well, former felon John D. White fled prison like a bat out of hell after being locked up for the 13 years, and then he strutted into Mount Pleasant, Michigan, like Lazarus himself, raised from the dead. The convict was now full of conviction. It seemed to the residents of the small town that Jesus had walked in. White had become a traveling pastor and had bounced around the state before setting his sights on Mount Pleasant's Christ Community Fellowship Church. The small congregation welcomed White with open arms, convinced it was God's will. He preached a good sermon and shared their beliefs, so they felt it was their duty to give him a chance. The Mount Pleasant community accepted the Reformed pastor as one of their own. He was friendly with everyone, a helpful neighbor who presented himself as an overall nice guy that would help watch your kids or build a deck in your backyard. You know, neighborly things. It was like Jesus himself had delivered Pastor John White to the small church and town, and the community was so grateful. They knew their new pastor had a sordid past. He was upfront with them, and I use that in quotes, about his run-ins with the law, explaining that in his younger years, he was involved with a woman who used drugs and died from an overdose. And so he panicked and he ran. The pastor explained to his flock that that's how he got locked up in prison. Clearly a lie, but as they understood it, they had no reason to not believe what he said. Why would someone tell you they were in prison and then make up a story? Had it not been for his time in prison, he wouldn't be the beloved pastor they had grown so fond of today. Pastor White had found the Lord in prison, gotten his pastor's license while locked away, and had been a model prisoner during his years behind bars. He spent most of his time in the chapel and devoted himself to hours and hours of studying scriptures, and it paid off. He was a reformed sinner, a success story. Look what God did to John White, his parishioners must have thought. And every week, He thanked them for giving him a chance to do what he really wanted to do, his true calling. He had repented and found acceptance, and he even found love with Sally Jane, who taught Sunday school. To anyone on the outside, it looked like a perfect tale of conquering demons and fixating on God. Little did they know, when he wasn't delivering sermons to the small congregation, White dreamed of necrophilia. And a few months after he began dating Sally, he proposed. They were a match made in heaven, or so it seemed. She eventually introduced him to her daughter, Rebecca, who was 24 years old and a mother to a sweet 3-year-old boy, Conway. Her son was her whole life. Rebecca even moved into the same trailer park as White and her mom, which delighted White. He could be close to Rebecca, visit her often, and even help out babysitting her son. But his intentions weren't so pure. And John D. White wasn't so subtle about his fascination with his fiancée's daughter. He even said to a member of the church, quote, "Isn't she a beautiful woman? Wouldn't you love to have that?"
The way that he treated her differently than other people. He didn't treat her like a daughter. You know, he treated her more of someone that he, you know, was really interested in. He stated that, "God, isn't she a beautiful woman? Wouldn't you love to have that?" I said, "John, for God's sakes, that is your girlfriend's daughter."
So it shouldn't come as a shock that some suspected White when Rebecca Gay, the mother of one, was reported missing when she didn't show up for work by her coworkers at Goodwill. Her family said she always kept in touch. She wasn't the type to just take off, especially without her son. What was even more suspicious, though, is after she was reported missing, her car was found abandoned and parked at the trailer park. As police frantically worked to figure out how White's fiancée's 24-year-old daughter had vanished, John asked his flock to pray for her. But all along, authorities said, he knew the sordid truth about where the young mother was. And others were increasingly becoming more and more suspicious of White. When detectives spoke with Rebecca's coworkers, they confessed that Rebecca was creeped out by White and hated when he lurked around her work and her home. Additionally, when White went into the local bar to ask the bartenders if they had seen Rebecca, they instantly got a bad feeling. They said he was acting super distraught and frantic, but they weren't buying it. And then they noticed fresh scratches on his face, signs of a struggle. The bartender pretended to try and calm him down, but she said the entire time the hair on the back of her neck was standing on end. She knew something wasn't right. Meanwhile, White is comforting Rebecca's mother and telling her everything would be okay. At the trailer park on Friday, pictures of pumpkins and other Halloween decorations were still on Gay's home. Park resident Matt Brown said, White regularly cut through his yard to go visit Rebecca's trailer that was one street away. Then, when detectives looked into his past, they were stopped dead in their tracks. They found out about his first assault and then the murder of Vicky Sue Wall. White was then finally taken into custody after Rebecca's body was found in a ditch not far from her home. White was backed into a corner and confessed and described the murder like this. He claimed that he had been thinking about having sex with a dead body for weeks. And on a brutally cold Halloween night in 2012, he was about to act on those lingering thoughts. And he knew just who he had his eyes set on. His fiancée's 24-year-old daughter, Rebecca Gay. John Douglas White was 55 at the time, and he told police he had watched necrophilia porn that showed killings and sex with corpses before walking into Rebecca's mobile home at about 2 a.m. to attack the sleeping young woman while her son slept in the room nearby. He entered her home and beat his fiancée's daughter with a rubber mallet and then strangled her with a zip tie before undressing her body. During questioning, White stated, quote, he had been having bad thoughts for her about 2 weeks before killing Rebecca Gay and then having sex with her dead body, the affidavit summarized. He said before entering her home, he had 4 or 5 beers. The young mom was awoken by the brutal blows of her mother's fiancé smashing a mallet at her head. He said that as he was beating her with the mallet, she looked up at him and said, quote, I know you.
She was breathing. I remember looking at her and saying, oh, I brought zip ties.
He then tightened a large zip tie around her neck until she stopped breathing. White said he then undressed Gay's body and touched her, though, like I said before, he said he does not remember if he had sex with her. He told police he tried to get an erection but couldn't, according to the court record. This would later be proven to be false, as forensics proved he raped her lifeless body.
I may have grabbed her breast. I tried to get up and wouldn't get up.
Forensic evidence from the autopsy proved that he did have sex with her. It was obviously some sick individual doing this heinous crime.
Then he placed her clothes and towels and her young body into a black utility trash bag and hauled her in the bed of his truck to the insulting burial place, a ditch, 2 miles from where he brutally murdered and violated her. The idiot, and I'm glad he is one, left neon towels soaked in blood and a pink t-shirt with Rebecca's blood in a regularly trafficked woodsy area. So unsurprisingly, her body was found shortly thereafter he dumped her. But Mr. White thought he had it all under wraps. After dumping the young woman's body, he went back to her trailer, mere feet from the one he shared with her mother, his fiance, and he drove her car and parked it at the local bar, and then walked back to the trailer where he was such a good Samaritan and then babysat Rebecca's son before dressing Conway up in a Halloween costume and delivering him to his biological father. After revealing this gruesome confession to the police, White had the audacity to make some requests. When in questioning, he tried to make a deal, quote, life without parole and PC, meaning protective custody, likely because he knew he would be destroyed in prison. And his other deal was he wanted to call his fiance and say this pathetic statement.
Hi. I just called to tell you that you are the love of my life, okay? And you're probably not gonna see me anymore or hear from me anymore, okay? Will you listen to me? I love you, and I am so sorry. But I can never fix it, okay? Bye.
Armed with his admission, authorities were determined to put John D. White away for the rest of his life. In April 2013, the 55-year-old White was sentenced to 56 years in prison. But only 4 months later, on August 28, 2013, White was found hanging in his prison cell just after 4 a.m. Prison officials attempted to revive the convicted killer, but it was too late. John D. White was dead at the age of 56, and he left behind a legacy of hatred and violence towards women. It was White's son Gabriel who may have summed up his late father's life best when he said, quote, he was completely crazy until the end. Rebecca was a beautiful young woman who was striving for an even more beautiful life than she already had with her young boy Conway. She had enrolled in college. She was working full time. She had so much unbelievable potential that was stolen from her by a man that should have been locked up in 1981 for the rest of his life. And so Vicky Sue Wall could have survived, and Rebecca Gay could have survived, and Teresa wouldn't have to have had to live in fear that her savage attacker was roaming the streets, harming and stealing the lives of other women. Well, sorry, but that was a dark one. And that concludes the horrific story of the vile monster, John Douglas White. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, the best thing you can do is to tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and a positive review. And don't forget to tag me in your Insta stories when you're listening. I love seeing how and when you're getting your 7 Deadly Sinners fill. Stay safe.
There is nothing resembling a man of God with this man. The devil can spell scripture from front to back.
John Douglas White was one sick son of a bitch.
Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.